Doom Patrol, Negative Man, Elastigirl, Robot Man.
Someone wants the Doom Patrol reunited.
Your every word and action
is being broadcast across the planet.
Now, Monsieur Mana!
Well done, my Doom Patrol. Well done.
It is too late for you, Calder.
Your beloved patrol is doomed.
Hello, and welcome to Waiting for Doom, the Doom Patrol podcast, where we talk about the Doom Patrol while we're waiting for new issues to come.
Yes, hello, I'm Mike. You can find me on Twitter at AvantGarve. You can always reach us at waitingfordoom@gmail.com. You can also check out mygreatestadventure80.blogspot.com, which is run and maintained by friend of the show, Doug Zavisha, with lots of more awesome Doom Patrol stuff. You can find the Waiting for Doom Facebook page, and all our episodes are available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Podbean.com.
My name is Paul. I'm reading underscore Hicks on Twitter. And you can also talk to our sentient show Twitter account, Wilfred, who's at WFDpod on Twitter. And we are sponsored by Comicosity, the awesome site for comics.
Yes, very awesome site. This week, I really enjoyed an article on there by Michael Hale, which was all about butt-kicking mums in comics.
Oh.
And it focused mainly on Lois in the Superman Rebirth stories of recent. But it also touched on kind of the Ellen Ripley effect, Ripley from the Aliens films, and also the Grendel's mother from Beowulf.
So, wow.
Bit of a mixed bag there, but yeah, that was a really interesting article, and there's always lots of cool previews and reviews and all sorts of cool stuff on Comicosity, yeah.
Yeah, check it out, everyone. Anyway, today on the show, we're going to look at Grant Morrison, Doom Patrol, Volume 2, Issues 51 and 52. Mm. So that's what's coming up. But Mike, how was your week in comics?
Pretty quiet, actually. I have not read a single comic other than the ones we're talking about in this episode since we last spoke. My comic pile sits there taunting me once again. The only other sort of pop culture related stuff happening at the moment is they've announced another Comic Street happening here in Brisbane in December, which was a really cool thing they did in the city business district earlier in the year with lots of independent artists and comic book creators selling their wares and you know, showing off their comics and the stuff they do. So they've just launched the second one of that is happening December 3rd. So I'll sort of be giving that a bit of a shout out because I actually missed the first one, and I am definitely going along to the second one now. It's on December 3rd, so I will probably, you know, put links to that up somewhere later on. And for those who were asking about the Thor filming near my work, I didn't get very close to any of the filming because there were lots of other people trying to do the same. So, there were lots of people there, lots of cameras. I didn't sort of get a chance to see anyone famous there. Yeah, and then once the crowd realized I was there, it was all, oh, Mike. So I kind of had to go back into hiding to work. So, and, you know, me and Hemsworth, it's kind of like you and that Wolverine fella, you know?
Right.
Strained relationship.
Jackman.
Yeah. Oh, Hemsworth. Oh, God, the stories. How's your week been anyway, Paul?
Yeah, I was at an anime and manga convention on the weekend called Smash. My daughter is had an artist table, so she was selling her prints and badges and charms. And so that was pretty cool. And
nice.
I did a lot of sitting there looking looking groovy.
You were the bouncer.
I was the bouncer.
Miss Hicks will not be answering any questions, thank you. And that is cash and move along.
Yeah, I sat there and read some Western comics. I don't know if that's allowed, but I did it. I broke all the rules.
Such a rebel.
So I read a Birds of Prey trade, the Chuck Dixon Birds of Prey run from the early 2000s, which was super cool. Holds up really well. Really great art by Greg Land before he was a Photoshop copier. And yeah, good stories. Good times.
Cool.
Yeah, and read a bit of Marvel. I caught up with Captain Hail Hydra America. So,
all right, give us your hot take on that whole thing.
Is
the story actually good?
It's ruined comics forever.
Throw out your collections, everyone.
No, it's just for those of you who want the spoilers, the Red Skull. He's the guy with the red skull. He has he's manipulated a cosmic cube which has become sentient and tricked it into making Steve Rogers always a Hydra agent since way back in his youth.
Right.
So he is, but I mean, you've got the whole quandary of, you know, Steve works for Hydra, but he's still got this sort of moral core.
Okay.
Which is getting strained at the moment working for Hydra. So, yeah.
Understandable.
So, interesting start. It's a good story. It's not going to break comics. Everything will be back together one day. It's fine. Just enjoy the ride.
Yeah.
I'm reminded of all the people who were so upset when Spider-Man was inhabited by Dr. Octopus's brain.
Which was, like, one of my favorite Spider-Man stories of all time and got me into Spider-Man comics. So, yeah.
Yeah, and didn't that go for 2 years or something?
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, yeah. It actually had a decent run. Mid-20s, I think it got up to, before Marvel Surprise rebooted everything again. So, yeah.
It's fine. It's well written. It's got good art. Yeah. Enjoy it. Yeah. Enjoy it. Don't panic.
It's comics, kids, you know.
Yeah.
The heroes never die. They always come back. Yeah, whatever. Unless you're the Doom Patrol.
Yeah. And I've been reading some Daredevil, Charles Soule Daredevil.
Okay.
Which has I wasn't really into it for like the first 6 or 7 issues. It was kind of like really nice art, but the story, it was underwhelming considering that Charles Soule is a lawyer. But issues 8, 9, and 10, things have picked up. So he started doing more interesting things with Daredevil's powers now, that because one of the things is Daredevil has got his secret identity back, so people don't know who he is, including his friends.
Right.
And so he keeps finding himself in situations where someone is telling him how to disarm a bomb and says, just cut the green wire. And he's like, they don't know, he can't see it and things like that.
Right.
One stage, someone's showing him a video on a phone and he's just staring at it going, uh-huh.
Oh, God.
But that's really fun things. You're playing with the powers. I like it. Hmm. So that started happening.
Speaking of powers, the other thing I have enjoyed this past week is Stranger Things. I finally got around to watching that. I'm about halfway through, and yeah, it's pretty good. It took a couple of episodes for it to grab me, but it's around episode 3, something happens in that, and I'm like, yep, okay, I'm on board with it now. So yeah, that's pretty cool. And it's done a really good job of capturing America in the 80s as well, like really well.
Right.
So yeah, I do recommend Stranger Things. You know, lots of people on the internet were raving about it, and yeah, okay, they were right.
I am yet to enjoy that.
You'll get there.
I will one day. Okay. Yes. Anyway, so I think it might be time for us to go down on Darrington Way.
Please.
So, first thing that came out on from Darrington Way this week is we saw the cover of Doom Patrol issue 3 from volume 6, which is the opening issue, and it's a fascinating cover. So. In this cover, we see Casey Brink, the female EMT person, and she is lying on her back reading a comic, which has it's called Danny's Comics, and it's dated March 1937. I'm not sure the significance of that date. But on the cover, it shows her trapped in the cover. Get out. And she's opening the book, looking into it, and there's this this creature coming out of it, sort of like a Cthulhu koala, a pink koala. It's a Cthulhu face, and it's got sort of metal fingers. It's quite, it's unsettling, but it could be really cute. Like, it could be a great soft toy one day. It's a cautious thing coming out like a hesitant alien.
It reminds me a lot of the old 50s and 60s sci-fi magazines.
Yeah.
That creature coming out. Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, but I like that this volume of the Doom Patrol is doing its own thing with covers. It's not sort of emulating any previous volume at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's fascinating. Yes, and the other thing was Jared Way on his Tumblr updated that he now has Doom Patrol issue 1 in his hands. And very classy. He thanked everybody involved. So he thanked Nick Darrington for doing the art. He thanked Tamara Bonvillain for doing the colours. Todd Klein for his fantastic lettering. James Harvey, who did the colouring and the sort of... design of the gyro or donor or kebab or whatever you're going to call it. Shelley Bond for her role in getting the book up and running before she left DC. Mm. Molly Mahan, who's also an editorial. Jamie Rich and Dan DiDio and Jim Lee. So, you know.
Very classy. People.
Yeah, and all the people who did the covers, Jaime Hernandez, Sanford Green, Brian Bolland, Babs Tarr, Brian Chippendale. And he talked a little bit about what's inside and who's it for. So it's something for everyone, diehard Doom Patrol fans, new readers like us, non-superhero fans like us, and more. And he promised it will be new and definitely different. So we will check that out and hold him to that. Mm-hmm. And it includes in the back a preview of Shade the Changing Girl issue one. Gorgeous ads for all the young animal books, his first editorial, and a back cover ad for the NC Comic Con. What's NC? Something.
It's not New York City, is it?
It no. could be. I don't know.
That'd be NYC. NC, not North Carolina?
Maybe. Anyway, and that's been illustrated by Nick, so it's a back cover ad for that. Cool. So, excited to see that.
Yes. I think it was maybe also a week or so ago, Nick Derrington posted a picture he'd done, a piece of art of a cyclopean-looking monster dude.
Mm.
And I got a bit excited because I'm pretty sure that was one of the Mutant Masters. From right. the 60s run, which I think we'll actually be getting to in a couple of episodes' time.
Right.
So they were just these weird-looking dude monster men, and they were awesome. And, yeah, if they make an appearance, I'll be very excited. I mean, I'm already excited for Volume 6. Who isn't?
Mm.
But, yeah, the fact that they're doing their own new thing but touching on the past as well, that's so cool. So cool. Yeah.
Cool. Anyway, I hear ticking.
So do I. And it has to be the Doom Clock.
Woo!
Okay, so the Doom Clock is telling us that, surprise, the last book we had for the Doom Patrol was issue 22 of volume 5 from the Giffen Clark run. That was cover dated July 2011, went on sale May 4th of that same year. So it's been 5 years and 16 weeks since the last Doom Patrol book. But, as we just said, volume 6 is on its way and it's a mere 3 weeks away. September 14th, mark your calendars. Mark it again if you haven't already. Never mind. The last appearance of the team was 54 weeks, one year and 2 weeks ago.
Wow.
We saw them in two different comics, All-Star Section 8, number 3, and Justice League United, number 12.
We were there.
Yeah, we were. That was such an exciting day when Justice League United 12 came out. Anyway, this week in Doom Patrol history, going on sale for the princely sum of $2.50 American, on sale August 25th, 2004, and cover dated October 2004, was issue number 3 from Paul's favourite volume, volume 4, from John Byrne.
I have that one.
Do you?
I do.
Do you have a letter in that one as well?
No letters in that one.
Not that one? Okay.
No, sorry.
This issue was titled A Cold Night's Death, and saw the team face off against giant monstrous creatures from beneath the Antarctic.
Ooh. Creepy.
Yeah, very creepy. We discussed the Burn Run in brief. It took up all of Episode 7, but we did a synopsis of the run in general back in Episode 7. So you can go and check that out for more. And be warned, we were maybe not too kind to it.
We will be coming back for a longer, more... less rushed pass through it, I believe.
Yes.
In the future.
We'll get there.
Look for it in the future.
All good things. Yeah.
The anyway. Time. Go there now.
That's it for the Doom Clock this week.
Don't call them babes. Definitely don't call them broads. But can we call them birds? Welcome to Feathers and Foes, a Birds of Prey podcast where we are celebrating the tales of the femme fatales. Superman flies above you, Aquaman rules below you, but the birds stand with you. Feathers and Foes, I'm your host Ashford, and in the studio with me is...
Hello.
Black Canary? Wait a minute, what did you do with Leah and Mark?
Did you just call me a broad?
No, I said don't call them babes, don't call them broads.
So you're saying I'm not a babe?
No, yes. I don't know. I don't see you as some object. I see you as a well-rounded character with her own wants, desires, and agency.
Stop saying buzzwords, hoping to gain a female audience.
Canary, how dare you question my sincerity?
That's Black Canary to you. Do you want me to plug your show or not?
Please plug my show, Miss Canary.
You can contact Ashford, Leah, or Mark on Twitter. The Twitter handle is at Feathers and Foes. You can also email them on the website feathersandfoes.libsyn.com. In addition to all of this, you may subscribe to them on iTunes. Just go to the search option and type Feathers and Foes.
Time for Doomsplaining, and this week we're looking at Doom Patrol Volume 2, Issues 51 and 52, which pick up again with the Brotherhood of Dada return.
Hooray! So,
hooray! These are both written by Grant Morrison. They both have pencil work by Richard Case, and the inker for 51 is Stan Wok. And they're both lettered by John E. Workman Jr., who we love as a letterer, who still works today. We're so proud of him. And the colorist is Daniel Vozzo. Ow. Now, there's interesting things about this one. So issue 51, it was cover date January 1992, but it was actually on sale on December 3, 1991. So just seeing out the year there. But it has a cover by Mike Sikowski with inks by Frank Giacoya. And there's an interesting story about this cover. It was actually created in 1964, I believe. And it's been sitting around the DC office, and somehow Grant Morrison heard about it, and it's from a comic that was never produced. So, yeah, they would come up with stories on the cover and then write a comic about it. So someone invented this character called Yankee Doodle Dandy, and this was the cover that introduced him. And he was a little bit of a question ripoff because he does this thing to his face where he has a gas pellet and a pen, and that blanks out his face, and then he goes and fights crime. But Grant Morrison took this and ran with it in a very Grant Morrison direction.
Didn't he just?
Yeah. Anyway, I'll take you through the story. So it opens with a TV newscaster, and he's bringing us all up to date on Mr. Nobody's tilt for the presidency. And Mr. Nobody is constantly harassed by law enforcement officials and violinists, according to this newscaster. And the new incarnation of the Brotherhood of Dada travel the country spreading psychedelia in their LSD bicycle-powered school bus. And the newscaster talks more about the Commandos of Confusion, as he calls them, and concludes, "This is Peter Kettle reporting," as the panel pulls back and we see he's actually a dude with no pants on wearing a TV box on his head. And he's getting arrested by the cops.
I love that scene.
Yeah, this came out, in the mid-80s there were lots of comics like Watchmen and DKR, like Dark Knight Returns, which showed people on TV all the time, you know, mm-hmm. doing parts of the plot and bringing up to date. So it's the sort of 80s grit with TV newscasters, and it gets immediately undercut by Morrison. It's very funny, and great work by Richard Case on that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, then to the suggested tune of Planet Love by the Dillons, we see the magic bus itself zooming through the desert. Nobody is inside peddling, powering the bike, not selling random stuff. So the bus aisle is strewn with random stuff. Mm. Yes. And Mr. Nobody is riding hard to find a TV station. So anyway, presumably at the same time, Cliff, the man robot known as Robot Man, and Crazy Jane are on the sentient transvestite street Danny, checking him to see if he's okay after his abduction by the Brotherhood of Dada in the previous issue 50. Danny's fine, and he tells us with smoke and windows and cards and on the street and stuff. In fact, he thought the Brotherhood were a lovely bunch, always laughing and able to put a smile on anyone's eek. Which apparently means face, as Cliff learns from Danny telling him. That sounds like something Martin Gray would say, doesn't it?
Possibly. It wouldn't surprise me. Yeah.
You might want to punch me in the eek for saying that. I don't know. Anyway.
Love you, Martin.
Love you. Anyway, off the street, Josh Clay, inside one of the buildings, he's the resident medic to the patrol. He used to be a superhero. Now he's just a doctor. He's checking up on Dorothy, who still won't talk about what's been bothering her since the incident under the Pentagon a few issues ago. He's getting absolutely nowhere, so he leaves Dorothy to her own devices. And then she gets off the bed, opens the wardrobe, and sees the monstrous monster with the crown of candles head and the menacing face. And it's the Candlemaker, who... She summoned it under the Pentagon to solve everything. And it's in her wardrobe. And then she slams the door and then it opens it again. It's gone. Yes. Mm. And she sees the wardrobe only contains coats. But her eyes well up with tears. So that's pretty sad. Mm. Anyway, speaking of the Pentagon, we cut to Major Maine, who's replaced General Honey from a few issues back. And he's discussing the Mr. Nobody problem with his aide, Ms. Roddick, as they ride rubber bouncing animals, toys. Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. And Ms. Roddick wants to tackle the Brotherhood of Data by fighting fire with fire. We want to use John Dandy.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. The Brotherhood of Data have arrived at the tiny WZGT TV station. I'm not sure where that is. Anyway, the two security guards draw their guns, but they're no match for Alias the Blur, who makes one guard clothes suddenly vanish, and the Love Glove, who sends a black glove in through the front of the other guard's shirt to do something depraved inside his clothes.
Yeah. What's it doing in there?
Anyway, upstairs, Mr. Nobody makes his televised speech with an enthusiastic endorsement from a man who's foaming at the mouth and wearing a straitjacket. And Mr. Nobody promises to make it Christmas every day, and the snow starts to fall in the studio as he says this. And Cliff and Jane, back on Doom Patrol's Danny the Street headquarters, are watching the telecast, and Cliff doesn't know if they should stop him, whereas Jane has a more open mind. When's the last time we had a president who wasn't rotten to the core? I'd vote for Mr. Nobody any day. Anyway, Mr. Nobody has moved on to his economic policy, which is about famous artist signatures on dollar notes, but they're forged by other famous artists and things like that. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
No, it's hilarious, but yeah, no sense at all.
Anyway, soon Mr. Nobody and Agent who has the exclamation mark for a name, are soon handing out toys to kids in a toy store as part of their Christmas everyday political platform. And then the cops arrive, so they flee on the bus, and the psychedelic bike exhaust makes the police give up the pursuit in favour of pulling over to have a dance. Meanwhile, still under the Pentagon, so this must be taking a couple of days to get there, Ms. Roddick and Major Maine discuss their plans for thwarting the Brotherhood of Data's propensity to force people to think in new ways. They can't have that. They've already sent an agent to work on the weak link that they've identified in the team, the Love Glove. Plus, there's also John Dandy. Anyway, Cliff is trying to prep the team so they can deal with the Brotherhood of Data. Danny can get into the side of the big Brotherhood of Data rally in Washington tomorrow, but Jane's stating she won't fight them. But Cliff says they just have to disable the bus, not fight them. Rebus is also not going to help. The Enigma Regis is coming, he tells them, and that's the next stage of his or her life cycle, and that takes precedence over this stuff. Cliff is flustered by Jane's question, why should we do anything? And then he says, because if we don't, then the Brotherhood is right and there's no point to anything, and I can't live that way. I'm going out there. And Josh decides to go too.
Wow, Josh going on a mission?
Yeah, sure. I know. Right, that evening, the Brotherhood of Data have made camp, complete with a campfire in the woods for the night, and Mr. Nobody comments that it's strange that the toy hasn't joined them yet because they've got another member, the toy, but she hasn't shown up.
Mm.
And the Love Glove wanders away from the fire, and he encounters a seductive-looking woman leaning seductively against a tree.
Ooh,
uh-oh. Anyway, we don't see what happens next. Anyway, then, meanwhile, under the Pentagon still, Ms. Roddick asks Major Maine if John Dandy can be trusted, and he said, that's like asking if you can trust a hurricane. You point him in the right direction and hope to God that when the shit stops flying, the enemy is in worse shape than you are. Anyway, he then details John Dandy's beginnings, which are remarkably similar to the cover of the comic. He began as an agent of the Unusual Operations Division, or the UOD, which oversaw the Men from Nowhere and the Sex Men, etc. And he developed a gas capsule that hardened on his face to form a blank mask, like the Question. to make him special agent Yankee Doodle Dandy, ready to kick ass for Uncle Sam. Anyway, eventually he went on a mission beneath the Pentagon and came back several years later a Grant Morrison designed freak. Anyway, and so they've arrived where he is, and Ms. Roddick said, "Where is he?" And then he's crawling above them on the ceiling and looking down. He says, "Ah, visitors." And he's got like draw handle ears, Scrabble tile nose, and the usual seven extra heads that float around him.
Of course, yeah.
Yes, and yeah. They will pick up your emotions and attack you with them. So they have to wear special glasses. So that is what happened in that issue.
Oh.
What do you think of that one, Mike?
I really enjoyed this one. I know I griped a bit about this storyline when we last covered these Morrison issues, the ones preceding it, sorry. But this one I really enjoyed. Yankee Doodle Dandy's an interesting operative. I don't want to call him a bad guy because he is kind of a bad guy. Anyway, the Brotherhood, I'm actually enjoying this time around. I still much prefer the first iteration of the Brotherhood of Dada, but this one I found their madness more enjoyable this time around. The last couple of issues. And I also really like seeing Mr. Nobody wearing costumes.
Yes.
Like he's got a Santa costume on in the toy store. When they pull over and have their campfire at night, he's got a chef's hat on.
Yeah.
And he's just, you know, he's really excited about life and his mission. And it's also really interesting to see the patrol at odds with each other as to how they're going to deal or not deal with the Brotherhood this time around. It's a really enjoyable issue.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they see themselves as agents of the status quo. So, you know, and Mr. Nobody is sort of forcing them to feel like they have to. And, you know, and some of the team aren't going to have that.
No.
Other things that stood out. I'd never heard the song Planet Love, so I looked it up on iTunes. And it kicks ass.
It's really good.
Yeah, it's awesome. So, I'm going to buy that one. It's just a really great issue. Just lots of good Danny stuff at the start.
Yes.
Yeah.
The interaction between the team in those scenes as well will show that they, you know, in their own weird way, they all care about each other and they want to make sure that, you know, they're all okay with, you know, Josh and Dorothy. God, I forgot her name for a second there. embarrassment. And Jane and Cliff and Danny, you know, all just sort of, you know, checking in on each other after the last bizarre encounter with the Brotherhood.
And John Dandy at the end.
Yeah,
he's a weirdo.
I do love how you said you know, he came back a Grant Morrison designed freak. It's very apt.
All right, now do you want to take us through the next issue, Mike?
Do I ever? Oh, let's do it. So, yes, Doom Patrol number 52 of this volume, cover dated February 1992, going on sale January 7th of that year. Cover price $1.50, edited again by Tom Robert Payer. Grant Morrison wrote it, Richard Case did the pencils, inks by Philip J. Bond. I think Case also did some of the inks in this one, I think. Letterer, Johnny Workman Jr., and colorist Daniel Vozzo again, and a really cool cover by Jamie Hewlett this time around. Kind of cartoony, you know, showing Agent alias the Blur and the Love Glove just sort of hanging out. Oh, and Mr. Nobody's kind of hidden there
yes.
at the bottom. I almost didn't notice him there the first time around. Yeah, very, very cool cover there. So we open the issue with John Dandy perched on the roof of a building, and we learn each of his many faces is a reservoir of unearthly power. It takes the seven floating heads above him to contain all his dreadful thoughts and imaginings, but even those may not be enough. And at present, one thought burns in the center of his brain, destroy the Brotherhood of Dada. And we are told, enemies of America, beware. Beware the man who always leaves a feather for his foes.
Ooh.
Spoiler warning, there'll be feathers turning up in this issue. We then turn to the political rally for the Brotherhood of Data, where the crowd holds signs reading things such as "Defy the tyranny of the predictable," "Art for breakfast," and "Disobey your mum."
No!
And as the Brotherhood excitedly prepared to deliver their speech backstage, Agent discovers a feather and remarks, "Hey, look at this, presents from the birds." Uh-oh.
Mm.
Yes, we learn that Cliff and Josh are amongst the crowd at the rally, and Josh is reluctant to fight the Brotherhood at all, but Cliff assures him that Mr. Nobody has as much right to free speech as anyone. So they'll hear what he has to say before things get out of control, and then trash his magic bus. And during this, a TV reporter has been interviewing members of the crowd to learn what it is that they love about Mr. Nobody. But when the reporter reaches Cliff, Robot Man points and yells, "Get that thing out of my face." Oh, Cliff. So very Cliff. Meanwhile, the Brotherhood sit down to begin their last supper. Their meals are placed on a table with the American flag as a tablecloth. I think that might kind of be illegal. I don't think you can use the American flag for anything other than a flag. But anyway.
I don't know.
As the others wonder what the hell it is they're about to eat, Mr. Nobody explains the food is yesterday's papers mashed into an absolutely non-nutritious pulp, and the drink is printer's ink. Useless paper, the bad dreams of a mad world, this is my body, this is my blood, drink and spit out headlines, cries Mr. Nobody. But suddenly he kicks over the table, blasts a note on a trombone that he gets from somewhere, and says, "Right, time to depart. Say it now and say it loud. I'm a trout and I'm proud. Fetch the painting that ate Paris. Make the submarine noises. Destiny calls." I just love his excitement in this story. Yes. Meanwhile, Bobby the Love Glove looks a bit unsure about all of this. And as he walked past the magic bus, the woman he met in the woods previously, she appears in the doorway to the bus. And she asks him, "Are you ready now? All you have to do is hold him until we can get to him. And as your reward, we can do all the wonderful things we did last night again." Ooh. Jeez. Bobby pushes her back and says, "No, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to betray them for a quick shag." Right.
Right.
But suddenly the woman reveals a gun and smirks, "You're pathetic. And I wanted to laugh the whole time we were doing it." And blam, Bobby is shot and tiny broken hearts appear in the air. Oh, poor Bobby. Meanwhile, Mr. Nobody begins his speech. He's representing the majority of people who don't vote. And his first task will be to wage war on the way things are. And even now, stealth bombers are leveling cities with stealth bombs without even the slightest trace of noise or damage. And you people are standing in the ruins as if nothing's happened. He blasts a note on his trombone again, and he pulls back the American flag to reveal the painting that ate Paris, telling the crowd all about the painting and that within it, nothing is impossible, everything is permitted, and if we all wish hard enough, we can dissolve the boundary between the painting and the real world. Who wants to try? And it's at this point that all hell breaks loose as government forces arrive with soldiers tear-gassing the crowd. John Dandy comes crashing through the roof of the stage and kind of crashes through the floor somehow. Alias a Blur goes on the attack, aiming for some soldiers, before Dandy swoops down on her and destroys her, smashing her mirror into shards. And as the shards fall to the ground, a feather falls with them. Yes. And we suddenly cut away to a hospital in Bremen, where the woman who became Alias the Blur lies in a hospital bed, and we see a monitor beside her, just a small regular size one, and a green horizontal line on a black screen and a single insistent tone tell us she's gone. Oh, so she's well and truly dead. Back at the fight, John Dandy is about to attack Mr. Nobody, but he tells him, "I honestly do think there's something you've missed. Don't turn around." But of course, John Dandy does, and he gets run over by the magic bus.
Awesome.
He gets knocked back. It sends him flying through the air. Agent emerges from the bus as it pulls up to the stage, but the soldiers gun him down. Suddenly, a small toy plane flies right between the two soldiers that shot him, with one of them remarking, "Jesus, that thing just about gave me the shock of my life." And the agent's final dying words are, "Ha, the element of surprise. I had it all along."
Because he always came as no surprise when exactly. People saw him.
And again, we see another feather floating in the background. But John Dandy draws closer to Mr. Nobody, saying all his freaks are dead and there's no one left to protect him. But just then a floorboard on the stage cracks beneath Dandy, causing him to fall over. And Mr. Nobody exclaims, "Number none to the rescue. The laughter around here never ends." So what was number none's deal again? He was just the unfortunate accident that happened to people?
He's the socks that go missing and the pens and, you know, the person who bumps into you and...
Right.
Yes. He's just unexpected mishap that you don't see coming.
Yes. So Dandy reaches up for one of the floating faces above him and he throws it at Mr. Nobody. And the face shrieks as it collides with Nobody, who yells, "Get it off, get it off." And suddenly, Mr. Nobody has a normal man's face, then a normal man's body. And as he's standing there in the nude, he realizes he's Mr. Morden again.
Oh, from the 60s Brotherhood of Evil.
Yes, the human normal man that became Mr. Nobody, just the way he used to be. And as he stands there in shock, John Dandy grabs part of the cracked floorboard and stabs Morden through the back.
Oh.
Yeah, ouch indeed.
That's not cool.
Not cool at all, man. Not cool. Before Dandy can strike Morden again, Bobby the Love Glove appears and he knocks back Dandy with a flying love glove. And Cliff finally reaches the stage and tries to comfort the dying Morden, who asks Cliff to get him back into the painting. Cliff picks him up and starts carrying him towards the painting, but the government agents see this and they open fire on it, and the painting bursts into flames. Oh no, shocking. Dandy comes to, he leaps in the air towards Cliff, but Cliff grabs him and throws him and smashes him into the nearest building, which is like a few meters away. And he goes splat into the building. With his dying breath, Bobby apologizes to Mr. Nobody for ruining everything, and as the painting continues to burn, Nobody slowly turns into a pile of smoke and ash. And he says, "I die, Horatio. I tried, but they don't want strangeness and unpredictability in their lives. They tire of it so soon that they never tire of tedium. Sooner or later, they'll wish they'd listened. One of these days you'll miss me, honey." And a feather falls to the ground, and Cliff says, "Shit." And just then, a strange-looking woman appears, apologizing for interrupting, but she says she was meant to meet some people, but got held up. I'm a supervillain, the toy. I'm not too late, am I?
Yes, you are.
Just a tad. And the episode, the issue ends with an epilogue showing us the now empty area where the rally was held, with the abandoned stage surrounded by vacated cars. And a young girl comes skipping through the area and she finds a scrap of the painting on the ground. And she looks at it for a minute before picking up a rock and throwing it through the window of a car, skipping away with a painting scrap in her hand. And we're left with the words of the English playwright David Rudkin, which read, "Cherish the flame till we can safely wake again. The flame is in your hands. We trust it to you, our sacred demon of ungovernableness. Cherish the flame. We shall rest easy. Child, be strange, dark, true, impure, and dissonant. Cherish our flame, our dawn shall come." What did you think of that issue, Paul?
Yeah, it's really interesting because the first time we dealt with the Brotherhood of Data, it was like 90% for comedy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's lots of wackiness and, you know, they had the adventure in the painting and, you know, thwarted the Horseman of the Apocalypse coming out of the painting.
Mm-hmm.
But this time it takes a dark turn. Like it's really rough seeing all the Brotherhood of Data getting taken out one by one and dying.
I can't believe how, well, not entirely traumatic, but it's kind of shocking in a way.
Yeah. And the feathers raining down and it's, you know, seeing this incredible free spirit of Mr. Nobody getting turned back into a regular person without all the, you know, the zany, you know, he has like Bugs Bunny powers and then suddenly he's turned into a person.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then he gets stabbed and, you know, and you think, you know, your hopes get up when Cliff is heading him into the painting and then the painting gets blown up by, you know, it's just full-on government agents, you know, soldiers and everyone, you know, everyone's out to get him and it's just for being different.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, and a bit of a metaphor there.
The man got them down in the end.
That's But, yeah, great end to this story. It's really dramatic and, you know, it pushes the Doom Patrol into a different space. As we said before, that, you know, they have to deal with, you know, who do they fight for now?
Yeah.
You know, and as it was, they ended up on the side of you know, Mr. Nobody and the Brotherhood of Dada, you know, resisting normality.
Exactly. And I think that's interesting as well because I think, I know for me as a reader, I'm going to assume this other readers felt the same way in that we were kind of rooting for the crazy, wild, wacky guys to pull through in some way and not get wiped out.
Yeah, I mean, in the first story they appeared, we were all kind of happy that they ended up safe in the painting at the end of it.
Mm.
You know, but in this, you know, Mr. Nobody's out in the real world and, you know, the real world isn't going to put up with him.
No.
Yeah, so, you know, kind of poignant and, a little bit upsetting. Yeah, but it's moving the Doom Patrol into a darker place again.
Yes. Especially with that thing that Dorothy saw in the closet.
Yeah, and the Doom Patrol is a team. There is no team in this story. Like, Jane won't go and fight them. Rebus is dealing with his next stage, whatever that will be. And, you know, Josh, who's a pacifist, comes as sort of a witness rather than an intervener into all this. So,
Yeah, it's not surprising that Cliff is the one that kind of leaps into action and Josh doesn't really do anything. But, yeah, he's stated for pretty much, you know, the entirety of Morrison's run that, you know, he doesn't do superheroics anymore. He'll help the team out. But even in this, he does very little.
Yeah. And great art throughout the story. I mean, you know, you feel the violence and every member of the Brotherhood of Evil, Dada dying is really hard hitting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You
know, even though they're just freaky.
I also really enjoyed the words from David Rudkin in the epilogue as well. And I actually did some research, and it's from the words come from a British television movie that he wrote back in 1974, which was called Pender's Fen, which was, from what I understand, about a teenage boy living in sort of rural England who was basically trying to come to grips with his place in the world and in society, and kind of has these almost hallucinatory encounters with pagan deities as he's sort of roaming the countryside. And, you know, to me, the words are like, you need to sort of have a bit of that spark within you to deal with the world and, you know, and that to me is what I really like about the way this story ended, is that you need a bit of crazy in your life.
Yeah.
You can't, I know I can't get by with just plain old boring tedium. And I much prefer people that have that spark within them as well. You know?
Yeah.
So seeing the Brotherhood gunned down for trying to share that spark. Yeah. It's a bit upsetting.
Yeah.
I mean,
as they said explicitly, they were just trying to change the way people think.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I didn't expect, the last time we covered the previous issues in this story, I know I grumbled a bit about, it's the Brotherhood and Morrison, but these two issues I really enjoyed much more than I remembered doing so last time I read them, which was some time ago, I'll admit. But yeah, reading them again now, I was just like, man, this was actually a really good arc.
Yeah, and the two covers of these are really interesting. Like Mike Sikarski, he was like a really active artist in the 50s and 60s and stuff. He was the artist on the first Justice League of America comic.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and he created Adam Strange, co-created Adam Strange with Gardner Fox.
Huh.
Yeah, so, you know, amazing that this cover was revived. And then you've got Jamie Hewlett from the Gorillaz and Yeah, and that's a great bit of art. So super cool.
Yeah, I find it really interesting that Morrison came across the Sikarski cover, and apparently the background is that they would create covers first and then create the story within.
Yeah.
I would kind of think it would be the other way around, but what would I know? I'm not in the comics biz.
Well, they're all in a hurry back then.
Ah, true. They didn't have computers and whatnot helping them out.
No.
But so, yeah.
Doomsplained?
I think so. It's been a good one. Yeah. Definitely, yeah. Doomsplained.
High five.
Well done. There we go. High five.
When you think of podcasts about religion, you probably think of this.
But at least one religion podcast sounds more like this.
I kick ass for the Lord.
Dorkness to Light is a relatively geeky production in which Alan and Emily discuss topics of faith, religion, and spirituality.
But we do so through the lens of pop culture, like movies, TV, and comic books, because we're nerds.
Our primary focus will be on Christianity, because that's what we know best. But all religious content is on the table.
Well, think about it, Scully, from vampirism to Catholicism.
This is an occasional cast, to be recorded and released as the mood strikes, with topics ranging from in-depth reviews to personal rants about some small aspect of theology or church history, because we're theological nerds.
If these topics interest you, check out dorknesstolight.blogspot.com for our more regular content.
Or dorknesstolight.tumblr.com for our more irregular content. Memes and puns, mostly. My bad.
Dorkness to Light.
Often irreverent, rarely sacrilegious.
Time for the Mailbag of Doom. And before we get into the new mail, I just want to say thanks to Jacob Edwards, because he was the first person who sent us pictures of the young animal Who's Who ashcan. Mm-hmm. So he's at ManPunchIt on Twitter. So thank you very much for that, Jacob. And everyone go follow him. He's cool. Now, last week on the show, we had the question, what's the best accessory? We had a little follow-up because Shmoby1 said the flash ring would be really good. And Ryan Daly pointed out that the flash ring, if you don't have super speed, it's just a ring that shoots clothes at people.
That could still be really handy in certain situations.
That's what I said. I've got kids. A ring that shoots clothes at them would be super handy sometimes.
Oh, look, I'm at a party and I've lost my outfit. I'll open up my clothes ring.
Yeah, awesome. And we got an email.
Ooh.
And this was also a comment on My Ghost Adventure 80.blogspot.com Doug's site. Anyway, he said, hello, folks. This is from Scott Arthur, who blogs under the name PBLFSDA. Catchy.
Rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, and he's been doing a Doom Patrol blog for years called LGC Doom Patrol, and LGC stands for Layman's Guide to Criticism, which is his philosophy of approaching the criticism of the Doom Patrol, which is... interesting. Anyway, he said, in podcast 67, which was our previous one, someone named Kevin, who we call Astrakus 1, asked about Silver Age Doom Patrol stories being reprinted anywhere other than the archives. And he said, well, aside from the two black and white showcase trades, there were several spotty examples of these before Crisis in the mid-80s. After that, DC was retroactively tweaking or outright rewriting the histories of most of their characters, so they were very selective about which Silver Age stories they wanted to have circulating. But he has done blog posts where he details where these had happened. So if you go to My Greatest Adventure 80 and look up the post for 67, you can see these links there. And then you can get into his site. And there's lots to read in his site, which is very interesting.
Yes.
So he talks about they were mostly, you know, in reprint comics that came out. He did a really cool way of calling it. So, you know, you've got Volume 1, which ended in 68, and then Volume 2 started in 87, he calls the interim period the Gypsy Years.
Oh, nice.
Which is a good way of labelling it, where the, you know, the Doom Patrol would turn up unexpectedly in places. And,
yeah.
Yeah, and there were two Gypsy Year periods between Doom Patrol runs, so that's interesting. Anyway. Anyway, so he's got lots of posts, so go read them. So that's from Scott Arthur. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
We're really pleased that someone, such a distinguished Doom Patrol blogger, is listening to us.
Yes.
Babylon. So the question of the week last week was, who's your favourite made-up spy person? And we heard from Martin Gray, and he said the real Nick Fury, which I presume he means the World War II one. And he said in other media, the ever-dying characters in Spooks.
British TV show. Well, that's nice. Yes. We heard from Alias Saul Bishop, who is at Saul Bishop on the Twitters. He said he's got to go with Nick Fury and Starenko's run.
Cool. We heard from John Ernan Poocht, who's jpooch21 on the Twitter, and he said Maxwell Smart is the correct answer. Yeah, good answer. Get smart.
Yeah. Rifty at Rift1821 said Boris and Natasha. There is no other answer.
Squirrel.
Wolf and squirrel.
Marcus at Registratus on Twitter said Beans Baxter from some Nickelodeon show I've never watched.
I think it was, late 80s, early 90s. I believe Beans was a high school student who did spy stuff on the side.
So wow.
It was balancing, if I'm recalling it correctly, it was some time ago. So, teenage super spy sort of thing. Yeah. Nikki at 100_beasts on Twitter said, I'm going to go with the members of the Cypher Pole 9 from One Piece.
Wow. I've watched a lot of One Piece when it was on TV years ago. Mm-hmm. I presume they made it TV safe. Because my daughter used to watch it when she was very young. But there were endless episodes of them fighting in a restaurant. Like, I remember this fight in a restaurant went for like 40 episodes.
Really?
Just that's what it seemed to me.
Right.
I used to call it the restaurant fighting show.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And I used to, whenever there was a piece of cake left, I'd say, "Arr, One Piece."
Oh, God. Who else did we hear from, Paul?
We heard from Chris Hogan, who's at Unlikely Nerd on Twitter, and he said, Archer is pretty damn fantastic. Yes, that is a funny show. You ever watch Archer?
Here we go. I've tried Archer. I'm not really into Archer.
No, I'm cool because I pretend to like it.
Right. Okay.
No, I haven't actually watched much. I know it's about a spy. It's animated.
Yeah. Yeah, I just, I don't know. I've only seen a handful of episodes and each one's left me scratching my head. Anyway, Robin, the Toy Wonder, or the Tie Wonder, sorry, at Ty Duggan writes, he said, I feel like Inspector Clouseau is more of an investigator, but he's up there for me.
True. Yeah. Well, that's a new listener. Or a new question of the week answerer.
Yes. Hello.
Hello. We heard from Corrine McCreary, who's Corrie Marie 21 on Twitter. That sounds familiar. We've had her before.
Maybe? I think Corrine might be a new responder / listener.
Anyway, she says very good taste because she said Tara Chase from Greg Rucka's Queen and Country.
Ooh.
Nice call. Yeah, good comic.
Cool.
And novel. Novels.
Novels, right.
Novels.
Okay.
Pamphlets.
Abel Padzilla at Abel Padzilla said maybe Kim Possible from the Disney TV series or maybe the two kids from the Spy Kids series. Having Machete as an uncle is a plus. Yep.
Bud A or Arbud F09 on Twitter, our friend, he said, I will take Maxwell Smart then. And the retro answer to last week's question of the week with the Cone of Silence is the best accessory.
Yeah, it's still cool. Still cool. Alan Middleton at Professor Allen said Secret Squirrel or Maxwell Smart? Maxwell Smart or Secret Squirrel? Animated is always better. Secret Squirrel.
Good choice.
Nice.
A rock or mall. We heard from Dr. Ange. Hey, Dr. Ange. How you going? Dr. Ange 70 on the Twitter. And he said, that was my animated answer. So Maxwell Smart is a great answer. So he's agreeing with Professor Allen.
Mm-hmm. We heard from Moby1, at Shmoby1. And he said he can't choose between the black spy and the white spy in Mad Magazine's Spy versus Spy. Yeah, tough call.
Good choices. We have from Jeffrey Brown, who's at Chizio on Twitter, and he said number 6, which I think is from The Prisoner.
That's what I'm thinking too. I have to admit, I've never seen The Prisoner.
Oh, you haven't seen it?
No.
Oh, don't tell Darren and Ruth.
Oh, okay. I hope they're not listening. Cover your ears, Darren and Ruth. Look, Dylan A. Lang at Holdill said Lester Girls. Another one I don't know.
That's from a comic, The Trouble with Girls.
Right.
Which is a Jared Jones early comic.
Oh, okay then.
There
we go.
Astrakis One, who's Wet Cheer Vile Metkin this week. He said Bond, James Bond.
Very cool. Richie O'Hara Beeman. Hey, Richie, at RickityOB on the Twitter, said Duncan from Mind Management is awesome. I was thinking Garak from DS9, but of course he's just a simple tailor. I love Garak from Deep Space Nine. He's so cool.
We heard from Big Tim Styles, who's at Big Tim Styles, coincidentally. He said, Mystique in her solo comic book by Brian K. Vaughan. Yeah, that was good spy stuff.
Okay, cool.
Never read that run? It was good.
No, I did not read that one.
Duh.
Oh, look, it's some responses from Ruth. Ruth Sutherland. She says her favorite fictional spy live action is John Steed. Of course, she chooses to believe he's real. That's John Steed from the Avengers TV show. And she said her favorite fictional spy animated is a Super Secret Squirrel.
Wow.
So there you go. Lots of love for Secret Squirrel.
A lot of Secret Squirrel.
Yeah.
Hmm. Anyway, so Mike, what's your response to the question of the week?
My response is the one that no one else has said, and that's Cool McCool.
Oh! Double O. C double O. C double O L. C double O L Mac. Cool Mac Cool. Dangerous is business.
He was awesome. You know, he only went for about 3 years in the 60s. He was created by Bob Kane, who, you know, co-created another little character called Batman.
But anyway,
may have, yeah. Okay. But yeah, Cool McCool was really cool. You know, he had cool catchphrases like, danger is my business. And that will never happen again when he, you know, kind of stumbled his way into solving the crime and stopping the bad guys. And he had such bizarre enemies like the Rattler and the Jack in the Box and Hurricane Harry. And oh, I just love that cartoon. It was so cool. So everyone else is wrong. Cool McCool is the best spy. Oh, I mean, what's your response to the question, Paul?
You're still interested in hearing that?
Yes.
I almost went with Sydney, is it Bristow? Bristow from Alias.
Okay.
I thought that's pretty cool, but no one can outspy Harry Tasker from True Lies.
Right. This is the Arnold Schwarzenegger True Lies film, right?
Yeah, okay. I love that film. I love him as a spy. It's very good.
Wow. Okay.
Did you kill people? I did, but they were all bad.
Wow. Okay. Wow. That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. And we got a special message on the Facebooks, I believe, Michael.
We sure did. We heard from a gentleman by the name of Michael Fife, who. Some of you may know him from the comics world. He wrote, "Hi guys, long-time listener, first-time peddler of anything Doom-related." And he actually was very kind and sent us a PDF of the latest issue of his self-published comic called Copra, or Copra, depending on where you come from, which is his, you know, his self-published love letter to superhero comics. So he sent us a PDF of issue 27. And said, even though it touches on some ongoing plot points, it's mostly a self-contained story that you might particularly enjoy. And I know I did, because Copra is kind of Michael's take on the Suicide Squad, but with lots more cool weirdness thrown in there and some really great art and great dialogue. And in issue 27, he introduces another team, which is kind of his take on the Doom Patrol. And it's really cool.
It was cool.
It was so cool. I won't spoil which team members he has in there. They're not all who you might expect, but it's done really well. So if you're interested, and you should be checking out Copra anyway, go and check out issue 27 as well. But yeah, you can find his stuff online. We'll try and put some links up to it as well. But Michael continued, "I felt a need for Doom Patrol comics to exist, sanctioned or not, thus this latest issue. Young Animal and Co. took me by surprise on the middle of me working on this, by the way. So either way, I hope you enjoy it. Regards, Michael Fife." Yeah, that was completely unexpected and, you know, really great to receive that.
Yeah, I read it and I was really impressed. And you can get them on Comixology, I believe, which is
that's right. Exciting. There's a sale right on now, I think.
And it might be over by the time this is aired. But
okay, yeah.
They're still there on Comixology.
Yeah. If you can't get it in print, go and check it out online. It's really cool stuff.
Yeah, it's copra. It's spelled like cobra, except with a P instead of a B.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Awesome. Well, I think that might be it for the show, Mike.
Mm-hmm. So what are we doing next week, Paul?
Next week we're doing a podcast.
Cool.
We're going to look at Doom Patrol Volume 1, Issues 115 to 116. So more of the Battle of the Mind Control Perverts.
Oh, good. I've been missing that in my life. And what's our next question of the week?
Who's your favourite character with a fin? Could be a fish character. Could be a character with a fin as part of their outfit.
Right.
Could be someone who just has a fin in general.
What if they have fin in their name?
Oh, yeah, you've busted my brain on that. I don't know. Look, I'll leave it to our listeners to answer.
Right. So, okay.
A lot of people ask us, can I answer this way? The answer is always yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Unless you're Aaron Long.
God, he said his name. we're going to get spammed next week.
Anyway, we would invite you to respond on Twitter at WFDpod. You can send us an email at waitingfordoom@gmail.com if you want to reply that way, or just send us a nice email. Facebook, Waiting for Doom Facebook page. And you can also go to Doug Zavish's blog, which is mygreatestadventure80.blogspot.com. And the best thing about his blog, it will have lots of pictures of the comics we talked about today. Mm-hmm. Or tonight, whenever you're listening. Tomorrow, if you're listening tomorrow. So you can go there and see the visuals. And it's just like, oh, look, I can see the pictures. I don't own the comic, but look, there they are.
Hopefully, it will entice people to go and buy the comics as well.
Yeah, go buy the comics.
Yeah. And you can also leave comments on there as well with each of the posts that Doug does for us on there as well, which is really cool.
Yeah. The cool people are leaving comments, I'll have you know.
Oh.
Yeah. Right. I've got a letter printed there. Anyway.
On that note, I think we'll sign off for now. Thanks very much for joining us again, guys, and we'll catch you again next time for more Waiting for Doom.
Waiting for Doom. Like plants seen on planet.